The gold standard for how a divided society with a violent past might work through the past and move forward was set 20 years ago by South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It opened up a way to talk about the wrongs committed under 43 years of apartheid, a government-imposed system of discrimination and separation based on race, based on skin color.
Welcome to the first special report on the Truth Commission. The Commission's first hearings were held here in the East London Town Hall, and it's been a week of raw emotion.
This report is from the South African television network SABC in the Commission's first week. Over 7 years, from 1996, some 2,000 people, perpetrators and victims, told their stories of what they'd done and what had been done to them under apartheid. One of those who testified was the mother of anti-apartheid activist Stephen Biko. He was killed in police custody.
I went into my room and prayed. Oh, Lord, what is wrong now? What had happened to my child?
The men who'd jailed and beaten Biko testified, too. They claimed they weren't responsible for his death. They asked for amnesty. The judge wasn't having it.
If you feel that you've done nothing wrong, is it really necessary for you to apply for amnesty?
Frankly, I think it's not necessary.
I killed Biko. You won't get away from me. That was your standard opening remark in relation to detainees, Mr. Siebert.
Your Honor, with the greatest contempt, that's a lie. Wait, that's not even a lie, it's a blatant lie.
He was allowed to rot in a cell, naked and ill-treated, and he came to the room and he was beaten, as a result of which he died. Those are the facts. Before they get amnesty, they've got to say who inflicted the fatal blow. They have evaded it. They covered it up then at the inquest. They are covering it up now.
Less than 1,000 got amnesty. Those who did generally showed contrition, sometimes directly to family members of the people they'd killed. Here's another excerpt from an SABC documentary about the hearings.
Saki Van Zyl leaves it to warrant officer Gert Lotz to kill Matthew Goniwe.
Terwyl die persoon voor my uitgeloop het, het ek hom met die veer van agteraf oor die kop geslaan.
While Matthew Goniwe was walking in front of me, I hit him on the back of the head with a piece of iron. He appeared to be unconscious or dead and wasn't moving. The black members then stabbed him with knives. I'm sure the family hates me for what I did.
Sal die familie my ook haat. Oor dit wat ek gedoen het.
I don't know. I don't want to use the word hate. It's a heavy word. It's a terrible word.
All this testimony was broadcast live, and all around the country, people watched. Some wept. Some scoffed. Some knew these stories all too well. And some were hearing them for the first time. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission recognized the pain of those who had suffered under apartheid and the guilt of those who made them suffer. It set down the details of a shared history so South Africans could move forward together. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission tried to show that no one was above the law, not even the African National Congress fighting against apartheid, not even Winnie Mandela, the former wife of President Nelson Mandela. She appeared before the commission, but she was at first defiant and unapologetic for the violence and kidnapping and murder that had been committed by young men who had lived and worked with her. She denied having anything to do with those actions, even though some of those young men said she'd told them to act. At the end of her testimony, her old friend and neighbor, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who was leading the Truth and Reconciliation effort, appealed to her to say more.
You are a great person. And you don't know how your greatness would be enhanced if you were to say sorry. Things went wrong. Forgive me.
I am saying it is true. Things went horribly wrong. For that, I am deeply sorry.
Thank you very much. We adjourn Sine Day.
In this moment, when we Americans are dealing with our own divisions, our own separate stories, our own tensions and violence and inequality related to race and racism and more, South Africa's experience is both an example of what's possible and of what's hard in moving a divided society toward a unified future. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstad. And it seems how you face your past has a lot to do with what kind of future might be possible. Different societies that have gone through civil war and social upheaval have done it differently. In the United States and in Spain after our civil wars, we basically decided not to talk about it very much. And to this day, in the United States, the North and the South tell different stories about what happened during the war and why. In Rwanda, in Cambodia, in Guatemala, Argentina, Chile, there have been different approaches, all trying to balance a need for some kind of understanding of what happened in the past, perhaps seeking some justice, without ripping the wounds open and starting a new era of strife. Each society has to answer this question for itself. But South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission was remarkable when it happened, and has stood as an example ever since. I visited to hear how South Africans are thinking about the TRC's legacy and how the transition's going from the old South Africa to the new. I started in Cape Town, a beautiful city on the southern tip of South Africa, with big blue skies, mountains behind, and the sea below. Cape Town also happens to have one of the highest murder rates in the world. More on that as we go. My first stop was a low, buff-colored building on a leafy street near the center of town that houses the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation. The Institute was created in 2000 to build on the spirit of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's work in South Africa and beyond. Its current director is Stan Hankeman, who looks youthful for someone in his late 50s. He grew up under apartheid, protested against it, and celebrated its end. To him, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was an extraordinary thing.
Well conceived, it did sterling work. It was led by one of the foremost personalities in the country. All people, you know, who commanded respect in society. And the interesting thing about it, it actually was a representative. There were even people on there with right-wing leanings. The reason I think why it is still regarded as one of the best truth commissions was that it actually went to the people. You know, it had these public hearings, and we all glued to our television sets.
However, he says, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission did have its flaws. Not everyone with a grievance had a chance to be heard. The Institute for Justice and Reconciliation here is trying to help some of those cases get to court even now. And, Stan Hankeman says, too few of the perpetrators who were denied amnesty were ever prosecuted for their crimes. Stan himself became active in anti-apartheid protests when he was in high school in 1976. That was the year of the Soweto uprising. He kept protesting as a high school teacher. He was even hauled in once by the police. But he says he never really expected that change would come anytime soon.
This liberation, if one can call it that, took most of us by surprise. In the 1980s, you know, none of us thought that we would ever... I didn't think I would see freedom in my lifetime. It all happened so fast. And so, in a way, we were almost unprepared for what happened. We all got caught up in this euphoria of, you know, it's not going to be business as usual. You know, things are going to change.
Stan says he felt that euphoria. He'd grown up in the Cape Flats. This was an area where white South Africans had dumped non-white, mostly colored South Africans, because the whites wanted to keep the center of Cape Town pretty much for their own use. Ever since, the Cape Flats have been centers of poverty, violence, gang activity, prostitution, and drug use. Under apartheid, the colored community there and elsewhere protested along with black South Africans, and many died.
So we were very happy to embrace Mandela's reconciliation message. And he epitomized reconciliation. I mean, he did the most amazing things that many of us said, I don't think I would be able to do that. But that came on the back of 27 years, at least, of reflection, yeah. Of deep reflection and a massive sacrifice, sacrificing his freedom. And so to make a statement like that, to show that level of magnanimous gesture, doesn't just come. There was a price that he paid for that. So when I say we, I mean all South Africans, but particularly white South Africans, didn't fully understand that whatever great things you want to achieve, you have to sacrifice. Something, you know, you cannot just get it without sacrificing something.
White South Africans would say they did. They gave up political control, even if they do still own a disproportionate amount of South Africa's land and wealth.
I just want to go back to an important event.
This is Jan Snyman. He's 70 years old, a white Afrikaner who, in the 1970s, worked in the South African government. He now lives in Johannesburg.
The election was on the 27th of April, the first democratic election, 27th of April, 1994. 2 years before that, there was a referendum in which F.W. de Klerk said, I have to go back to my constituency and ask them, can we go the new South Africa route? Can we go the new democratic route? And people don't pay enough attention to that. 69.7% of the then electorate, which were white, said yes, that's the direction we're going to go. And we must never forget that.
And sure, Jan says, there are still some white South Africans who say de Klerk sold them out, and South Africa would be better off if everything had been left as it had been. But Jan thinks they're in a minority, even among Afrikaners. He himself grew up in the Afrikaans-speaking Free State. His grandfather, who had the same name, had fought in the Anglo-Boer War. The Jan I'm speaking to was 2 years old when apartheid started. He says he didn't think much of it growing up because nobody talked much about it.
Very segregated community. There were no black people and in the school with us. Didn't exist. Afrikaans and English, yes. Even on the farms with the black kids, we played together. We swam together and we played together and that type of thing. But we never realized, I think, as kids, what the main problems were and why we were segregated and why they would live in mud huts. And we were in a farmhouse and so on. It actually never came to us. It was, you know, we not even discussed it, to my shame.
Huh. So do you remember when you started to realize what all that was about?
I think at university, when you start go to university, it opens up. You get to meet different viewpoints. But this may be a surprise to you. One of the big aha moments in terms of my life is when I met President Mandela in jail on Robben Island in, and I'll tell you exactly when, 1973.
So tell me about how you came to be on Robben Island in 1973.
That's an interesting story. After I taught for 3 years as a history teacher, and I then joined the Department of Information, so that was when I started with my communication career in Cape Town. And we were, my job was to organize the itineraries of overseas, prominent overseas people that came to visit South Africa. People may not realize that, but the government then was quite open.
Jan was arranging interviews for a journalist named David McNichol, who was with the newspaper The Australian. He said he would come to South Africa only if he could interview Nelson Mandela, and the government said yes. And that's how Jan Snyman ended up on Robben Island in 1973.
And there I sat, for the first time in my life, hearing the other side of the story from the future president of South Africa. And what was very interesting, there was a senior person of the Department of Correctional Services there as well. And he constantly interrupted Nelson Mandela. And the things that Mandela then said in early 1973 were the same things he said when he got out of jail in the early 90s. Exactly the same things.
Like what?
About like a democratic society, vote for everyone, each one must get a vote, that type of thing.
What was the guy saying when he was interrupting?
He was then counteracting by affirming the Nationalist Party policies about separate development and apartheid and that type of thing, while Nelson Mandela was giving the other view. But I can still remember it was like a very broad view. You could see that the guy had the vision of where South Africa was supposed to go and was going afterwards.
How did you feel personally about him as a person, as a human being in front of you?
You know, everybody always said that when you meet Nelson Mandela, it was just like a different atmosphere because of the personality that he was. And I experienced that, exactly that.
After that encounter, Jan went on to be a press attaché in the South African embassy in Israel. He says he didn't much like having to defend apartheid. So when he got home, he switched to the private sector. Banking, public relations, teaching. When Mandela became president, Jan welcomed what Mandela did to ease South Africa out of what Jan thinks was an untenable situation with apartheid, untenable morally and untenable economically. And then there was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Jan remembers how he felt watching it on TV.
It was, for me, absolutely shocking to hear what black people went through when they testified about the killings and the murder and all of those things that happened, because it was live on television. And I remember once or twice Bishop Tutu, who was the chairman, actually cried. So the lasting effect was, I think many complained to say they didn't go far enough. But I think it was a good start. It was a good start to get it out, to tell people what was happening. Should they have gone further? Should many people have been, you know, gone to jail? I think one or two did of the terrible things that they've done. But it was certainly an eye-opener. And people can accuse me, how did you not know, et cetera, et cetera. That's fine. And then they can accuse me. It's also because of the system and where I grew up and the environment and so forth. But I think it was a shock to many Afrikaners of what was going on. And I think to a certain extent it helped in terms of reconciliation. But it's going to take a long time.
It will take a long time. These things do. And yet, stroll on a college campus like Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, one of the top universities in Africa, and you will see mostly black faces. During apartheid, you would have seen very few. And more black Africans have moved into the middle class in South Africa. Per capita GDP has doubled since the end of apartheid. And then there's the less good news. The unemployment rate is about 25%, higher if you include those who have stopped trying to look for work. Part of the reason is ineffectual governance, particularly, many South Africans say, under President Jacob Zuma. But also, race is still at play in insidious ways, similar to how it is in America's inner cities. Communities are still pretty segregated, and the schools in non-white communities are rarely as good as those in white communities. Some of the schools in colored areas still teach in Afrikaans, which only 13% of South Africans speak, and which isn't exactly a language that will take you far in the globalized world. I talked to a young woman named Sandiswa Sonzaba. She's a 22-year-old master's student in geography. She had a wake-up call about how wide the educational divide is in different parts of South Africa when she was in 11th grade at an elite girls' school. And she volunteered to go teach in a rural black community.
And we did a community service program in Limpopo called Pedi Shang. And we went to one of the schools there and we were teaching grade sixes. And it was actually quite a significant moment. I mean, it's a moment that I haven't forgotten, where we asked one of the students what 2 times 2 equals. And that student didn't know what the answer was. And also, I mean, you see that even in university, that people who went to like private schools or former Model C schools, they are in a better position compared to kids who come from rural and or township schools. Also, with a lot of kids who don't come from upper middle class backgrounds, a lot of them tend to disappear from the system as a result of economic struggles. So, I mean, the government has spoken about looking for funding for the missing middle, and also there is the student loan program known as NSFAS. But if people are starting with debt when they graduate, which is also a problem facing America and a lot of other developed countries, how are they supposed to facilitate their families in terms of accessing upward social mobility? Yeah.
So you were born a year after apartheid ended. How do you think the legacy of apartheid has affected you and your life?
I mean, within my immediate family, we're well educated. So my mom has 2 master's degrees, for instance. So we have managed to gain some sense of upward social mobility. But at the same time, I mean, you kind of see it when you're out with your friends from other racial groups. You're kind of expected to assimilate. And for the most part, I have.
assimilate with whom?
I mean, white culture, you know, like where as a black person, you're expected to speak in a certain way to come across as intelligent. You know, if you speak with a black accent, you're seen as less intelligent than someone who speaks with a European accent. But I guess in some ways, like you see with your extended relatives, a lot of them have a lot of skills, but as a result of apartheid with job reservation, a lot of them did not necessarily get access to the opportunities that their white counterparts did. So a lot of them are kind of stuck in terms of, you know, just doing well-skilled but not too skilled labor, you know, blue-collar labor. And that has negatively affected their social mobility almost.
There is affirmative action to get more black South Africans into colleges and jobs and even sports. 20 years ago, this seemed necessary to right the imbalance after decades of apartheid. But now, some people are starting to complain, especially people who were classified as colored in the old South Africa. Colored, that meant you were mixed race or from indigenous tribes that had lighter skin than the Bantu tribes that had migrated from Western Africa to South Africa hundreds of years ago. During apartheid, the whites gave the colored community a few more privileges than blacks, though not as many as whites.
It's almost like the field slave versus the house slave.
This is Brendan Adams, who grew up in Elsie's River, one of the Cape Flats communities near Cape Town.
The master was, and his family was, the minority. So in order to create friction between the two slaves, what he did was he gave the house slave a little bit more than the field slave. That caused fighting. And now the lighter skin is going to listen to the master more than his own, you know.
He says those few extra privileges didn't mean those called colored had it easy under apartheid.
I'll jump right into it. My first experience as realizing that I had to grow up very quickly was around 8 years old, you know, when I saw my friend getting killed in front of me because of racism. This huge white policeman just started beating on both on us. I got away, so I'm here to tell the story, you know, and unfortunately he didn't make it.
A huge white policeman started beating on 2 8-year-old kids.
Yep. Just because of our skin color. And that's when I realized that something is off in this world, you know, and I wanted to know more about it. I couldn't do anything about it.
That was in the late 70s. In the 1980s, Brendan realized he could do something. Like many so-called colored men and boys, he started taking to the streets and fighting apartheid.
Oh, yes. I was thrown into the deep end. And most of my high school years was part of when Nelson Mandela was released, you know. So we were part of that freedom fighters, which they called the Young Lions.
So you were out on the street protesting?
Protesting a lot, yes.
What did you expect post-apartheid? What did you expect life would be like for colored people in South Africa?
That all people of color, and I'm meaning all people of color, were finally gonna live together as one, because we fought as one. We really thought it was gonna be different. And for a while, when Nelson Mandela was in power, it was different. Nelson Mandela looked at us as human beings, you know, not by the skin color, not that you are colored and you are Khoza and you are Zulu. We felt like South Africans. Unfortunately, I feel we're back to that apartheid years where now we are in groups again, group areas. And I remember when Nelson Mandela took over, his words was, if the ANC do to you what the old government did, get rid of them. That was his words, you know. And we actually see that happening now.
So speaking of that,
yeah.
There was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It sounds like you personally had a grievance. I mean, your friend was killed in front of you. Your life was at risk in that moment.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the work that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission did and the legacy that it left?
It actually was a good situation. I just wish they interviewed a lot more colored people as well, you know, because the devastation in the colored communities, even though it wasn't as much like in numbers like the black communities, the colored communities lost a lot of freedom fighters in the apartheid era. I mean, we've seen people falling, comrades, we called them, fell next to us. You couldn't turn around because you had to keep running.
This is when you were in high school and you were on the streets. You had people falling dead next to you.
Yep. Dead, injured, or, you know, just police catching them. Trust me, you would rather want to be dead than the police catching you because they will torture you. And I've met some friends that was caught by police, and the stuff they went through traumatized them. And it still traumatizes them up till today, you know. There's this freedom fighter in the colored community, Mr. Danny Brown. He waved that ANC flag 24/7. He's older now, he still does it. Now he does it because he wants the ANC to realize I was fighting for this party. I'm still in my neighborhood. Nobody is looking after me. It's like they don't recognize what the colored community did with them, you know. Cape Town is one of the most evil cities in the world as far as gangsterism is concerned. And that is just, that's something apartheid caused.
Brendan's talking about places like Elsie's River, the place where he grew up. He's moved on from there. He met a Minnesota girl, married, and moved to Bloomington, where he now drives a school bus and teaches and directs South African gospel music. But he comes back to Elsie's River regularly to work with young people and encourage them to skip the gangs and the drugs and stay in school and have a future. This is through a group called the New Hope Jeremiah Project, which provides meals and after-school activities and a little Bible study to dozens of kids. It's more or less a family project. It was started 40 years ago by Cornelius Hayes. He's now 63, and just about everyone here calls him Pa.
I grew up very poor. That time I married my wife, we stay in a place, so it was a very small place. Since that time, we feed food left, or I go buy something, I see my neighbor haven't got, and I share with him.
He's got a thick Afrikaans accent. Many people of his generation do because they didn't really learn English. So he's saying, we started sharing our food with our neighbors, and then we started working with the kids to try to keep them away from drugs. That worked on his own daughter, Shantae, though she says even for her, it wasn't always easy.
Well, there was a lot of challenges. I was like sitting around with friends when I was in grade 11, and the crystal meth was like all around me. They were trying to get me to use some of it, and I just refused. I clearly had a choice to make, and that was my choice. I chose not to do it.
And what about your friends?
There's a lot of them who passed away, from the drug crystal meth. Some of them are still on it and alive, but they look very, very unhealthy and sick. They have a lot of children. They don't work. They steal. It's actually very, very sad to see them like that.
And you now have a pretty impressive job, and you've spent some time in the United States. You're back here. When they look at you, what do they see?
Well, they either think I'm busy with smuggling drugs, or because they can't, like, here you don't get work from our people or the government. So I'm employed by an American doctor, and when they see me drive around with the car that I have, or they see how I look, I'm healthy and I'm looking after myself, they either think I'm dealing drugs or I'm doing something, some sort of illegal activity.
Because it's that rare that someone from here makes it with a normal job. Shante is an exception in that way, but she's also still living with her parents. She doesn't make enough to get her own place. She wishes it were different. She wishes she'd been able to get into college. But she says when she went to apply in her early 20s, her high school told her that they'd thrown out her transcript. She doesn't know why. And then there was the fact, she says, that universities and, for that matter, government jobs in South Africa still have affirmative action. It means that in Cape Town, where more than 40% of people are classified as colored, they get a 9% share in universities and in some workplaces. The 9% correlates with how many people classified as colored are in South Africa's population overall. It's just that most are concentrated in the Western Cape. So here, they have to get much higher grades to get into a local college or job. Many just give up.
It's a vicious cycle. They can't get into college. There's very intelligent guys living around here. They will come do odd jobs. They will fix your car. They will fix everything just for crystal meth because they can't get that job that they always wanted. I spoke to one of my friends the other day, and I asked her like how she's doing and stuff, and she told me like she doesn't feel like living anymore. She's got 3 children. She's never been married. She's 24 years old. And she's also on crystal meth. And I ask her, like, you know you're in the situation. Why are you still using drugs? And she says it's just to forget about the pain. That's what most of the people say.
Testing 1, 2, Nazi.
While we talk, there's a sound check going on outside.
1, 2, yeah. 1, 1, Clinton, Kiki, play in between monitor.
Pa and Brendan and their friends have set up a stage in a cul-de-sac near the park, and they'll host a little concert here tonight. They do this every year. It's to raise people's spirits, get parents interested in letting their kids come here after school, if they go to school. Some parents can't afford the uniforms and books, and that sort of starts the downward spiral where kids end up getting involved with drugs and gangs and crime. The singing starts and the little kids crowd in at the front of the stage, smiling broadly, eyes shining. The teenagers hang back, arms folded, looking a little skeptical. The late afternoon sun is casting long shadows on the crowd. Janae says the concert used to go till midnight, but there's been so much gang violence around here lately that they'll wind it up early tonight. How much gang violence?
There's a lot of murders almost every day. They use small children to do the stuff. There's like 10-year-olds laying on the roofs with snipers. The DA that's ruling the Cape asked the ANC many a times to send in the army. They don't send in the army. Because they want us, basically, we feel they want us to kill each other so we can ruin out the colored population in Cape Town. That's how we feel.
Outside, the singers include neighborhood kids, a visiting family of gospel singers that Brendan has brought from Minneapolis, and this group from the Cape Music Institute, gifted music students, many themselves from the Cape Flats. The bass player talks about sometimes having had to step over bodies when he's come home from practice. The group launches into an apartheid-era song called Paradise Road.
The young man.
The crowd listens, but not with visible emotion. Many are too young to know this song. For them, apartheid was a long time ago. And anyway, it's not like their problems are over. These music students, though, may be on their way to an interesting future. They're studying under the founder of the Cape Music Institute, a celebrated jazz keyboardist named Camillo Lombard. He himself grew up classified as colored, but he says he now considers himself Khoisan, a descendant of the original indigenous people in this area. He thinks it's good to know where you came from, but not to get too hung up on it. I ask him how he thinks the transition has gone from apartheid to what South Africa is today.
The talk about the Rainbow Nation in 94 was good. It really gave us a sense of togetherness. There's a word called Ubuntu, and which means, you know, united togetherness of people. But I don't think that the healing process has taken place. We haven't healed from the scars that we were wounded by pre-94, pre-democracy. And so I think that a lot of our people need to heal in order to move forward, and we need to forgive the past and move on, you know. Because if we walk with that thing on our shoulders, the white man did this to me, or the black man did this to me, we're never going to get past ourselves. We're going to flourish as a people. So I think in order to become the Rainbow Nation, and a real Rainbow Nation, is to move past the past. There's a lot of mix here in the Western Cape. A lot of the slaves of West Africa and East Africa have settled in Cape Town and mixed with the indigenous people here. And so we've got the DNA strands of everyone in the world here in Cape Town. And that is so amazing about Cape Town being cosmopolitan. You see a so-called colored boy walking with Chinese eyes, but he's brown skinned. You know, or he's got very straight hair, and he looks like an Indian, but he's colored. Or he looks fair and he's got green eyes, but he's got coarse hair, but he's colored. So there's a huge mix. There's a European mix, African, East Asian mix. The people of Cape Town, when they rise up, they can really unite people, and we can be a real Rainbow Nation, because we, like I said before, we can pull all the other nations together.
What do you think it'll take to heal? Is it really just something that happens within each person, or is something more needed beyond the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that happened?
I think it's about talking about it, having conversation and dialogue, you know. I'm sure there are so-called white people that are also hurting right now because some of their privileges have been taken away. And so we need to have a conversation and a round table and really talk about these issues that are bothering us so that we can get past ourselves.
In other words, more of what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission made possible. Not necessarily more details of atrocities, but more sharing of experiences, less siloing of different communities. Perhaps one lesson from South Africa's experience with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is that this kind of work is never really done. Generations need to keep working at it if they want the kind of society the Truth and Reconciliation Commission tried to make possible. That's true in South Africa, it's true in other places that have tried these sorts of processes, and it's true in America, more than 150 years after the end of the Civil War. Those ghosts still haunt the present. We can face them and talk about them, or be overtaken by them. It's evening now at Elsie's River, and Camillo takes his turn on stage. He hits the keyboard, tears it up, and the crowd is right there with him. But it's only later, when the gospel music starts, that the crowd really comes to life. Then, pretty much everyone's up, dancing, clapping, jumping, raising their arms toward the night sky. For this one moment in Elsie's River, nothing else matters. The music runs through everyone, and the sins of the past, the burdens of the present, and the uncertainty of the future vanish in a swirl of joy.
Okay,
My thanks to Brendan Adams, Judge Lejeune Thomas Lang, and Matt Intenza for making it possible for me to visit the Elsie's River community and hear a side of the South African story that's not often told. If you'd like to see a print version of this story, you can find it at pri.org/century, where you'll also find all our previous episodes. You might especially want to listen to one about what can happen when people don't face the past, told by my colleague Nina Porzuki about a little Polish town where neighbors killed their Jewish neighbors during World War II and then tried to make the world forget about it. You can hear all our episodes on iTunes and most other podcast apps, as well as Stitcher and SoundCloud. If you like the podcast, do me a favor and leave a review. It helps others find it. I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. And you can send a longer message to whosecentury@gmail.com. Whose Century Is It is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Back soon with another episode. Thanks for listening.